Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And hey, we also have Ken over in the chat room. And today, for our little celebration of, what was it, yesterday or the day before yesterday, longest day of the year, so I was able to mow the yard outside of the heat of the day. We're going to have a little free-for-all, a little melee here, which opens things up a little more than usual. We do on occasion take callers, especially from the usual suspects who have used their secret squirrel to give us their personal phone number. And we also like to pull questions out of the chat room for our guests. Well, today it's just Eagle One, myself, and you. So you have an extra opportunity if you want to try to put us on the spot, or if there's a topic you would like to bounce off us that you haven't heard us before, now is the time to do it. You can call straight in to the switchboard, area code 347-308-8397, 347-308-8397. Or if you feel that your inability to speak and your speech impediment is worse than mine and you don't want to share it, feel free to go over to the chat room and you can roll it in there with Ken and the other usual suspects as a pop in. And if we get bored with our topics, we'll go ahead and maybe bring yours in. Some of the things that we're probably going to talk about today, it's going to be no shock. If you've been reading the same things that we have, then you're probably going to recognize a lot of the issues. But as usual, I have a page of issues I'd like to talk about, and I know my illustrious co-host has the same. We'll only get through about 10% of them, and that means before you know it, the hour will be over. So, hey, well, first of all, Eagle One, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi, Sal.
I was about to get the paddles here. Wanted to kick it off because I know it's what's sucking a lot of the oxygen out of the air, and I just wanted to kind of throw my two cents in it. I've been kind of not horrified, but humored by a lot of what's been going on with the revelations about the National Security Agency. And my take has been, since this kicked off, is, and I think most people who've been in the business know, that what you're reading in open source is maybe a shadow of a glimmer of what's actually going on there, that we have a pretty good system of checks and balances. I still trust it. I still have faith in it. I think what's more interesting, though, has been the uninformed discussions, whether it's Snowden. Snowden worked for one of the Beltway bandits. But you know the old phrase of blind men trying to describe an elephant? He was in a place where he was picking the toenails of one of the elephants, and that's what he's talking about, is the toenail. But I've been real interested in the uninformed commentary, bringing out some of the baseline issues in our republic. And if anything has disappointed me, it's been that, though not shocked, but a little disappointed, is the politics of it have been interesting in that some people's, not all by any stretch of the imagination, but some people's outrage seems directly proportional to who is opening the levers of power in the executive branch, where I think if we had the other political party in the executive branch, we'd already have the usual large puppets and naked people beating drums on the Washington Mall by now. And you've also had the ongoing discussion, which I think is good and healthy, about the trade-off between freedom and going into a surveillance society. You know, and what price do you have to pay for freedom? I've never liked the argument, well, if we can save one life or we can stop one attack, then it's worth doing. Because what is the price you're willing to pay to have a relatively free society where innocent people and free people are allowed to go about their daily business without worrying about some GS-12 having access to a database that knows more about their mistress than you do. I have found that disappointing. I think that most free people are willing to accept a certain level of danger. Are you willing to accept one Boston attack a year in order to know that as a free person, your individual personal data and privacy is nobody's business but your own? Or are you willing to have one Boston attack every 10 years and then having a government having a huge database that catalogs all your associations, whether you're innocent or not? I just think that's been a very interesting, whether it's germane to what is going on with the NSA or not, a very interesting, if not healthy, conversation. Though I don't, from what you at least look on the surveys, I don't really like the results. It seems like a lot of our countrymen feel free to give up their freedoms and to take their chains in order to feel a little bit safer. But the other part of me, Eagle, and this is what I'll throw it over to you, is I think some of those polls are either not worded right, because I just don't see the vibe in the nation of more people wanting less liberty and less freedom. I think there are a lot of people who want that, but they really don't know how to get there without being a little bit scared. What are your thoughts?
It's a complicated subject, made more complicated by the fact that if you use Gmail, Yahoo Mail, any of the major mail connections, you know they're reading your mail. You know that if you put something in there about I'm looking for a new car, somehow they manage to put a bunch of new car ads on your mail page. So, you know, you have to look at this as a question of, are your individual, is individual information that isn't already out there being revealed to somebody, and is that information being used in some way to go against you? And, you know, is the effort, the real effort by the government, one of those ones where you really, they establish, they're trying to establish that baseline. This is our normal level of communication to various places, and they're looking for those spikes, those outliers, where something would indicate what they used to call chatter, a lot of chatter, a particular area, a particular region, which may be an indicator of something coming. I think that the you're talking about the amount of risk you're willing to take. Part of the amount of risk you're willing to take, you've already decided when you allow Gmail and these other places to have your mail, because they're not I'm sure they're not scanning it personally, but they've got some machine that's looking at it and trying to figure out what you're up to in terms of things they can sell you. So,
isn't there a difference between privacy for the sake of commercial interests, like oh my god, I'm going to wake up in the morning and I have 8 more pieces of junk mail in my post office box, and the lack of privacy and excessive information in the hands of large central governments. Large corporations don't have the same track record on abuse of power and individual freedom and liberty than do large central governments. And is that really part of the concern? And is that the argument that should be taking place? Because I know a lot of people, right after 9/11, when the Patriot Act was passed, a lot of people were reassured with the thought that, yes, there is a concern that some U.S. data or data from the U.S. might get swept up if that communications is taking place from the U.S. to a foreign country or a foreign national, as opposed to gathering and cataloging data internally for people that really are under no suspicions. And again, I'm not one of these black helicopter people, and I think we have a pretty good systems of checks and balances that I have confidence is taking place in the background. But there are cases of governmental overreach, and where bureaucracies are people, and people in bureaucracies can take and abuse information at their will, whether it's there are many cases involved where sealed divorce records magically become unsealed when somebody in the courthouse decides to unseal them and deliver them to somebody, or cases such as the IRS recently, where people can't abuse data for political reasons if they deem fit. Is that more of the concern that, that people should have, is not the government itself, but the people in power in the government?
Well, I think the IRS is a perfect example of people in government using their position to engage in activities which thwart freedom. And whether you agree with the Tea Party movement or not, to single out people who or groups that are part of that, to single out individuals who've donated money to that group, I mean, that is completely wrong. That is the power of government. An individual in government may not have been, and let's assume that the best of all possible cases for the administration is that it was a few rogue agents, as they like to say, who did all this. But that is exactly why you have to have restrictions on the power available to government, so that those rogue agents can't do the sorts of things they were doing and cause a limitation on the freedom of debate in our society. And I mean, that scandal to me is the worst of all of them. And I don't think we've even really scratched the surface on it yet, because I don't think we've climbed all the way up the ladder. But giving them the best case, a couple of rogue agents, it just shows you that that's the kind of power that government should not have. And as an argument, I would assert that we need to change our tax system to get away from all this nonsense where people have to beg the government for some kind of status to go forward with whatever their views are. I mean, maybe they didn't have to do that, but this tax-free thing nonprofit organization stuff is, that's just an unfair system. And, I've already announced several times I'm in favor of a fair tax thing where you pay a sales-type tax and you just get the government out of the process, as much as you can, out of the process of collecting taxes.
I think you're spot on there. I mean, some of the former Soviet republics have a system where you literally can pay your taxes on the back of an envelope. And as any tax attorney can tell you, I don't care how good you are. If you have a few IRS people sit at a desk and have access to your information, you have violated, especially if you're a small businessman or any size business or a person who's got complicated, you violated the tax code in some way because it's impossible to understand. And if there would be any good byproduct to come out of this, I would hope it would be a drive to create a system that minimizes the level of abuse. The higher the complexity, the greater room there is for abuse. Simplify it. That's the ultimate way to make it fair. It would require a significant change, though, in our political leadership right now, because there's just too much invested in keeping the system the way that we have it right now. But it's, I think what would help a lot in this, and it sure would help me, because with each passing week, I'm feeling more and more Pollyannish. And this, for this reason, we need perp walks. If the folks at Enron got perp walks for what they did, we need people in the IRS with marshals on either side of them, in front of the press, their hands behind their back, marched off, arrested, and charged. People need to go to jail. People need to be able to see that the government is able to self-regulate itself, where people have abused their power, they are charged, and they are arrested, and they are held accountable. The old hang one, terrify a thousand point of view. Absolutely,
yeah,
positively.
That assumes that... I don't know if we'll see that, Sal, because I'm saying the best case administration is there are a few rogue agents, and as Scott notes in the chat room, that you can always track down a few rogue agents. But if this thing goes up the food chain, like I suspect it does, I don't have any proof, but other than I think everybody so far up the food chain has lied. If it goes up the food chain, are they going to prosecute themselves? This is the first time in many, many years that Congress ought to appoint an independent prosecutor to look into this and to get down to the bottom of this. Because if you trust the administration to go after this on their own, you're asking the fox to guard the hen house.
Yeah, I don't trust them. I'm, because of its abuse in the past, I'm not a big fan of the independent prosecutor route. I know they changed the law here in a bit, but I'm not an attorney. But part of our self-regulating system, at least in my little innocent corner of the world, it's slow and it's clunky, but it functions, is if we're going to get stonewalled by this, if those who have been granted a good bit of liberty via the First Amendment will use that and will continue to beat the drums, then we'll have elections, and elections in 2014 and 2016 can take care of the problem if the government can't. And that's my hope, is that there'll be enough people who are granted great powers in the First Amendment to help educate the American public, so via the ballot box, we can hold people accountable if the executive branch is not going to do what it needs to do. Yeah, that's a little Pollyannish, but and speaking of Pollyannish, we could do an entire semester on this topic alone. Speaking of Pollyannish, let me roll this to you here, Counselor. This Snowden character, I don't know about you, but if you're a whistleblower and you really love freedom, you don't run away to China, Russia, Cuba, Venezuela, and then Ecuador. I don't think there's any whistleblower in this Snowden character at all. I'm not a psychiatrist, but how would you have advised this young man if he decided to take this route?
Well, if he had an ounce of the moral courage he purports to, he would have stayed right where he would have blown the whistle, stayed right where he was, make him prosecute him, and face the music. And what better way to get your story out? I mean, I don't understand why he's gone the WikiLeaks sort of path on this. Although my wife and I were having a good time this morning when they were trying to find him landing in Russia. I said, he's probably sitting in an airplane in Bolivia someplace. So, while they're all chasing around, if he's got any crafts skills at all on this.
Yeah, I don't want to think that he wants to land in Russia, because he's going to find himself in a small room with peeling paint with two chunky guys in ill-fitting suits talking to him in an aggressive manner. I really don't think he wants to do that. And here's the big shame of it. We have serial killers that have fan clubs in this nation. So anyway, he has fans. And the shame is, and I'm going to be bipartisan about this because there are good people on both sides of the political spectrum, is if he really felt that he knew something in his low little contractor position that undermined the liberty of this nation. There are people on the staff of Senator Wyden and Senator Paul who are good people on the left side of the spectrum and the libertarian right side of the spectrum that take this stuff very seriously. And he could have found a way to have somebody who probably had the same classification he did, or at least pointed the way. And if anybody wants to know how to communicate with the Senate or the press in a way that leaves no fingerprints, there's a couple of great articles on board about how to do it with a burner phone. There's lots of ways that people can put information in responsible hands if they think there's an issue going on here. And that's the real shame, because I know there are people in other senators and representatives, obviously. I'm just picking those two as two counterbalances that on both sides of the spectrum, there are people who are very focused on personal liberty. If there was really something that needed to be done, that would have been the responsible way to do it.
Yeah, I think that the shame of this is that by letting everybody know how good our system is at tracking, either we're looking for outliers or whatever, but we're monitoring this stuff. It's just like revealing that we're able to track bad guys through satellite phones. Well, they quit using satellite phones. Bad guys are going to, if they know what we're doing, they're going to find ways to communicate without going through this stuff. I mean, there's nothing wrong with a simple letter sent through the post office, apparently, because it's really hard to electronically intercept that, or a note passed. I mean, the old ways work. It's kind of like trying to do electronic warfare against an enemy that's using signal flags. It won't work, and it only annoys the people trying to use the tools to track those folks down.
Yeah, it's there's obviously more to follow on here, and the knock-on effect is when you look at a lot of what's going on, nobody's shocked this type of surveillance is going on. The nature of it, what you're reading in open source is probably 10-15% accurate. And I'm not saying that because I know. I'm just saying that because of things that I do know about that I see in open source, I have a good giggle over, go, well, they kind of got it, but not really. But I think the system, slow and clunky, will take care of it, and we'll work it out in an imperfect manner. We'll work it nonetheless. If it doesn't, we've got bigger problems than some contractor from WBB taking it. Was it WBB this guy was working for? I forgot what contractor.
I can't remember.
They're all the same when you boil it down. I also found it interesting. A lot of people initially dismissed him. Well, he's only 28 years old. Dude, 28-year-old people could do a lot. I wouldn't dismiss him because of his age. I mean, Alexander the Great did some pretty dandy stuff by the age of 19. But I think he's put himself on a path that, if not already, he's going to have a lot of regrets. The vacation packages to Ecuador aren't really hot. Hanging out in Cuba might be pretty good until you have an abscessed tooth. And, Russia, the nude beaches in Russia aren't much to talk about. So, yeah, he's made his own luck. I don't wish him luck. I wonder if we'll wind up having one of those circumstances that in 5 or 10 years he's going to turn off into some U.S. embassy and take his hits. It'll be interesting to watch.
Yep.
So what you got on your list?
Well, I thought we ought to talk a little bit about Syria. And we seem to – the president has announced his famous red line on the use of chemical weapons, and now he says that they've used chemical weapons. And, you know, I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop. Have you had any indication that or any thoughts on now that we've got this red line crossed, whether we're going to do anything or are we going to continue to gum this thing to death?
We're gonna gum it and gum it, because really it's too late to really be able to affect significant change. You know, throwing a couple of light weapons in the mix is not what's going to be able to solve the problem. I think it might actually be counterproductive. A few things. One, going back to what I talked about, it's interesting people's reactions based upon their politics. But a lot of the stuff that we're reading about chemical weapons, it's 2003 all over again. You get two intel guys in a room, you'll get four different answers. And if you throw two of them away, you'll get the answer that you're looking for. Whether they've used them or not, there's also the place, if you put out, say, if the Syrian regime uses chemical weapons, then we're coming against them. Well, I got news for you. If I'm involved in an ethnic-based and religious-based civil war, which what this is, and you just told me you'll back me up if my opponent does something else, and my family, my tribe, my village, my valley is going to be destroyed, man, woman, child, and goat, if I don't get more help. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to find some way to make it look like my opponent did what you said is a red line, and then you'll come in on my side. I'll pray on it later, but that's how I save my valley. So, who's used it? I don't know. They've overrun, the rebels have overrun bases that have chemical weapons, so they've got access to them too. It's a big mess. I think it's stupid in a variety of ways. First of all, if Turkey isn't motivated to cross the border, then I don't see why we should be. There's really no geopolitical reason that would justify us walking into that morass that already has claimed tens of thousands, almost 100,000, depending on who you listen to. People so far. There's no appetite in the public to be able to do that. Nobody really wants to die for the Sykes-Picot Treaty of almost a century ago. We have Al-Qaeda trying to kill Hezbollah, Russia, and Iran in the middle of a proxy war in a part of the Arab world that even the Arabs don't like. I don't see how interjecting us in the middle of that would make any more sense than the Austro-Hungarian Empire interjecting itself in the middle of our civil war. I do not see any upside for us doing any more than we did, besides telling Turkey we'll back them, telling Jordan we'll help you as much as we can. But besides that, doing more in Syria does less for our nation, especially because whichever side wins, there's no upside to us. There really isn't. I don't. I don't. I have yet to be convinced that there is an overriding national interest for us to come in on the side of Al-Qaeda.
Well, if you were Turkey or Jordan right now, given the way the current administration seems to have waffled around, and the way Russia is just, you know, they're sending weaponry in there and supporting Syria, current leadership, pretty firmly along with Iran. If you were Turkey and Jordan, are you going to, how serious are you going to take a promise to the U.S. at this point? Oh, we'll back you up.
I think only a fool, based upon our history, only a fool would put their kingdom on the line for that. Turkey has enough problems internally. I don't think they want to do anything. If they wanted to do anything, they already would have done it. They've got the military forces to do it. But they know that place better than anybody else. That used to be theirs until a century ago. If you put a regiment in Aleppo, you'll have a regiment line at minus in 6 months, and you'll have accomplished nothing. Let them burn it out. Let them figure it out. And if Syria winds up breaking into two or three different nations, okay, then that's Syria's business. You could also make the argument that people have a right. I think it's actually enshrined in our founding documents that people have the right to choose the government in which they wish to be part of. And if a certain part of the Syrian people say, you know what, Alawites and Christians, we get along okay. We like the coast. We've got these Russian guys who want a base here. They're going to back us up and give us some money. And we can set up a system where we don't have to deal with a bunch of Sunni extremists that are blowing up everybody over the globe. You know, we would like to have a nation two-thirds the size of Lebanon on the coast. And if the Kurds want to do what they want to do on the other side of the country, that's okay. We don't like them anyway. You guys in the middle, you fight it out, and we're just going to stay over here. What business is it of an English-speaking nation in North America to tell the Alawites and Christians on the coast of Syria that they have to climb in bed with a bunch of people that they really have had nothing but bad blood with forever? And if the Turks don't want to force that, U.S. Marine Corps sure doesn't need to force it. And from a ground combat point of view, there's a reason why in the mountains of Syria and Lebanon, for that matter, you have ethnic minorities that are surviving to this end. Because even at the height of the Arab Muslim armies and of the Ottoman Empire and everybody else, those entities have been able to fight for their little piece of ground because it's very, very easy to defend and to make somebody bleed white to the point they leave you alone. Enough armies have thrown themselves against that wall. There's no reason for us to do that. And I would also say, us getting more involved by supplying weapons at this stage of the game, that is a slippery slope. Okay, you do light weapons, you do medium weapons, you start sending advisors in. We've been down this road before. It always ends in tears. I would like for somebody to give me an example of the last 150 years where it hasn't. I don't see it.
Well, speaking of things going to end in tears, Afghanistan.
But, oh, geez.
Now we're negotiating with the Taliban. The Afghan government, such as it is, seems to be either encouraging that or discouraging that. I'm not quite clear anymore.
Depends upon
what
if
are
he's
we
on
doing
his
there, Sal?
Well, it's everybody, the listeners here, they know my standard issue elevator speech on this. The die was cast in December of 2009 with the president's speech at West Point. When you announce a calendar-based withdrawal, a harder word is a retreat, everybody should put their red hat on. What would you do? And it's playing out almost exactly how you would expect it. You're going to husband your forces with your red hat on, i.e. the Taliban. You'll do enough to be an irritant. You'll do enough to remain viable, and you'll start sending messages to those that are on the fence. They're leaving. I'm not going anywhere. So I think you need to start making peace with me. And then as they start to leave, you kick them just hard enough, not to make them turn around and re-engage you as hard as they did before. You kick them just hard enough so when they go out the door, you can look back and say, I just kicked them out of here. A strong power does not negotiate with its enemy as it's retreating, i.e. talking with the Taliban. The only communication that needs to take place involves heat and pressure waves, but that's not what we're doing. We're also, there's an article that went out about a week ago, what we can't retrograde with, which is a fancy way of saying retreat, what we don't retrograde with, we're chopping up into scrap because we don't A, think that the Afghans are sophisticated enough to maintain a diesel engine in an MRAP and to be able to put air in a tire when it goes flat, or B, we don't want these things turned over to the Taliban after the central government falls. If you need any other indication that we totally abandon the conditions-based approach of shape, clear, hold, build that McKernan built for us, that is it. You cannot say that you have properly trained the Afghan forces on one hand, and on the same hand say that, you know what, they're not sophisticated enough to maintain an MRAP with a diesel engine, so we're just going to chop it up for scrap and sell it. It's predictable. You know, what is our version of the friendship bridge going to be? I don't know. It's not going to be a helicopter off the top of an embassy, at least no time soon, but I think a lot of it will come out with the next election. But the Uzbeks, the Tajiks, and the Hazara leadership, they'll do what they need to do to maintain some kind of control in their parts of the country. And then they'll work with the Pashtuns and the Taliban, as they always have. And that's sad. Was it inevitable? I think you can argue both sides of that equation, whether we could have stayed there another 10 years and would have had the same result. I don't actually believe that, but I am a firm believer that when we made that speech in December, and we did make it, the president didn't, the president represents the American people. When we made that speech in December of 2009, we advertised to our friends that we quit. We advertised to our enemies that the field was theirs. The only open question was when the calendar was. This fighting season isn't even going to be a complete fighting season because we're already taking equipment back. The fighting's done. It's just who's going to fold up the last flag and who's going to be the last group of advisors that doesn't have a green on blue experience and comes home. And then the Afghans will work it out the best they can. That's kind of my not too exciting and encouraging take on it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's much to add to that. This week in the mail, I got a book that B.J. Armstrong, who's a lieutenant commander in the Navy, wrote called, it's edited, it's 21st Century Mahan, Sound Military Conclusions for a Modern Era. And one of the interesting aspects of what B.J. did, at least in the start of the book, is he points out that Mahan was writing about situations that could be pertinent today, a rising power in the Far East, and so forth. And let me commend people, BJ's book. I don't know if you had a chance to see it yet, but what you said earlier about how some things, history seems to repeat itself, I think BJ has got a pretty good handle on how Mahan anticipated a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, I'm about halfway through the book right now. I believe BJ is up in the chat room, so He can send us a shekel or two for pimping it, but I think it's really good. And one of the great ways that I can recommend it to our listeners is it brings Alfred Thayer Mahan, who people who don't understand history and are wrong thinking look at, hey, there's a funny guy with epilepsy and a pretty hipster looking goatee. He doesn't have much to say about what's going on right now. Could not be further from the truth. And BJ has managed to boil down a lot of Mahan has to say and puts it in a context that makes absolute direct sense to inform discussions about what's going on today. Because like Clausewitz and a lot of the other great thinkers, you can go back to Sun Tzu if you want to be multicultural about it, the fundamentals are the same. The whole key is to be smart enough and humble enough to realize that you don't have to reinvent the wheel every generation. You can go back to the hard work others have done, take what they've had to say, and say, you know what? 90% of that fits perfectly right here. So let me go ahead and accept this premise, and then I'm going to expend my effort on improving it on top of it. And I think that's what is very good for the military professional to be able to grab BJ's book and read it, is you're going to bring into your brain bucket one of the great minds and take that information and add what you are experiencing to it, and it just makes for a better thought process in the long run, like all history does. And I will say this, and I kind of teased BJ offline about this, and he kind of took it wrong, but it's true. A lot of times when you think, oh, Mahan, Clausewitz, all these guys, oh my God, you think there's this big, thick tome that's going to make your brain bleed because it's written in this opaque academic language. Completely opposite. BJ has created something that's not a tome. It's digestible. It can fit it on the back of the toilet. You can put it in your coffin rack in the ship. You can put it on your Kindle. It's very approachable, and nobody should suck their teeth because they can barely make it through the latest episode of Sports Illustrated and feel like it's not for them. If you're just a Sports Illustrated and Rolling Stone guy, or if you're somebody that likes to, you know, get naked and roll around in libraries full of books written in the 1700s, either way, it's a very good book for people to get hold of, and it's priced right. I like that.
Yeah, I think you did it. The nice thing about it is it's not just another iteration of the history of Sea Power. BJ went and looked at all the other works of Mahan and has digested those, so you don't have to, but it made it very readable, very understandable, and points out how appropriate it is for our date and time.
I also like to point out the Naval Administration point ties in really well to the CNO's message that came out last month. I like that, too.
Well, I wonder why. We were talking earlier, before the show actually started, about this the launching of the unmanned aircraft from the aircraft carriers, and you made some pretty good points. You want to kind of discuss where you are on this
Are we talking about the unclassed, the confidential, or the top secret? What do we call our airplanes now? Good Lord! No, I love this.
I think is it UCAV or UCLASS or unclass or no class? I can't remember.
Somebody needs to be beat with a large rod and have their Navy commendation medal taken out. Anyway, what's really neat is, first of all, I'm a big fan of unmanned systems. They've been around for decades. They're just getting better because technology enables them to do it. I think the first iteration we're going to have is going to be a great thing to kick in the door. It's basically a recallable multi-use TLAM. If we look at it that way, then I think, you know, we'll see what Spiral 2, 3, and 4 brings us. But I think people need to be humble because we've been at other periods of time where people get a little hyperventilated and exciting because they think that everything's new and we've got this magic, shiny new toy that's going to totally revolutionize and change everything so we can throw everything else away because this is going to be great, this is going to be revolutionary, this is going to be, what are all the cliches we hear, you know, transformational, game changer, et cetera, and so forth. And what I found, and BJ, feel free to nod your head here, 1892, number 62, the issue of Proceedings from 1892, there was the prize essay for 1892 winner, written by a William Laird Clowers, an associate honorary fellow of King's College in London. Sound familiar? And I just wanted to take a moment and read something. It's going to be a long quote, but hey, it's our show. We can do what we want to, right? And I'm just going to read from it. Take a little sip of water here. Long quote. Title of it is Torpedo Boats, Their Organization and Conduct. Long quote. When the automobile torpedo first appeared as a possible factor in naval warfare, its value, like that of the majority of new and startling inventions, was generally misapprehended. The weapon, it was first widely believed, would not only create novel conditions, but would render vain and useless all the ancient principles by which warlike operations at sea had been previously conducted. Large craft of all kinds, the swift light cruiser and the slow heavy battleship alike, were to go down at once before the diminutive torpedo boat, which, besides undertaking the scouting and commerce-destroying work that was old performed by frigates, corvettes, and sloops, was to bear a conspicuous part in the defense of coasts, harbors, and estuaries, to do all the duties of the dispatch vessel, to take a leading share in fleet actions, and, in fine, to carry everything before it and to be irresistible. It is not necessary here to inquire how these exaggerated ideas of the mission of the torpedo and the torpedo boat arose, but it may fairly be suggested that the veil of mystery, which by all the earliest users of it was thrown around the Whitehead torpedo, did much towards fostering the misapprehensions. Even of the officers, only a select few were permitted to form any judgments of what the torpedo actually was. The rest, familiar merely with the outside of the weapon, were taught to regard it as a kind of fetish, the powers of which, if unknown, were also probably unlimited, end quote. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, I think I just read that recently in proceedings about the LCS, didn't I?
Yes, you did. And I think that's an important discussion that I've had offline with a few people, where the hype is open source, is public, is often cribbed by journalists from press releases. The concerns are classified, not because they are secret, but because by classifying them, they're left behind. People will come out of briefs, turn around to company-grade officers, field-grade officers will hand them stuff and say, share this with people, I can't do anything more with it because of the concerns with some of these systems. That's where there are a lot of people who like to push back against people I call the anti-transformationalists, those of us who share a healthy skepticism about the cheerleading and the world is new, war is new, this will take care of everything hype that goes on, because it has always been that new systems are overhyped. And if that isn't properly countered, like our good friend from King's College did in 1892, then significant decisions can be made that can put a fleet at operational risk and as a result put a nation at strategic risk because its fleet cannot perform its duty when the bullets actually start flying. I just thought that when I read that, I literally started laughing out loud.
Well, didn't our friend Norman Palmer have a piece recently about a substitute perhaps for the LCS?
I feel kind of guilty about even bringing up the F word. Can I say it? Sorry, Bob.
I think it's okay. It's our show.
I almost feel guilty. In Norman Palmer's article, for those that haven't read their proceedings yet, it's up near the back. He has two articles. One, talks about the fact that our Navy does need frigates, and the other is a nice little historical piece about the old school frigates. Because a lot of the opponents have been dismissed, opponents of LCS have been dismissed as rearward-looking troglodytes, the same goobers that are asking for the battleships to come back, blah, 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 kind of insulting, really. I'm more than happy to be thrown into the same lot as Norman Palmer. If I'm going to be wrong, I'll be wrong with him. That one thing he brings up as an option, which I don't share, You don't have to have 100% overlap with people. You know, he brings up the options of doing new construction of a modified Oliver Hazard Perry. I would much rather do a new design or a modified Euro frigate, one of the better designs there, as an option to LCS. I think, as we've talked about before, I think that option became less viable about three years ago. We missed our opportunity there, and I don't see any leadership that is willing to come forward on the record to do to the LCS what Vice Admiral Tom Connolly did to the F-111B. I'm looking for that guy, but I don't see it.
Yeah, I did a bunch of research on the Euro frigates that are available, the South African frigates, which are based on the MECO 2000 design. I think, I mean, there are a lot of really interesting ships out there, lessons we could learn from, that are somewhere in between. I mean, you know, of course our frigates now are the size of World War I battleships, but somewhere in between the Corvette and the frigate, there's some ship in there that we need that's got, it carries all the capabilities, sort of like a Gearing class historic, carried everything. It wasn't necessarily the best at anything, but it sure did carry a hell of a lot.
And it gave you lots of options. I just noticed in the chat room there was some people who joined the show late when I was in the middle of my long quote. That quote is from issue number 62 of Proceedings from 1862. It was from the winner of the essay contest in 1892, William Laird Clowers. He was an associated honorary fellow over at King's College in London. The title of his essay was Torpedo Boats, Their Organization and Conduct. It's kind of neat if you ever get a chance to get a hold of these old proceedings and read a lot of the articles. Like you saw in Clowes, however you pronounce Clowes, just call him Laird. He's dead. He doesn't care if I call him Laird. When you look at how Laird writes, it's also, I think, a nice demonstration that there is a good naval history of throwing some elbows and putting people on report for their ideas, not personally. But there was a lot of hysteria about the torpedo boat, and that lasted for when did the people finally realize torpedo boats weren't all that in a box of chocolates? Is pretty much after Pearl Harbor, right? So a half a century plus of torpedo boat fetish theory.
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole, I guess, was it the Russian fleet that attacked whoever it was off the coast of Russia with torpedo boats and just scared the hell out of everybody? So, you know, that went on, and, you know, a lot of our Navy proceeded from there. Like, the original destroyers were anti-torpedo boat destroyers,
yep.
And then they grew, just like the LCS, into some unrecognizable beast. But, yeah, I mean, that's a scary thing, especially if you had good torpedoes. I mean, I can't imagine the Japanese... I think underutilized their long last torpedoes, and Lord knows they did enough damage as it was. So,
yeah, well, it sure woke up us. There was also an interesting article that I've read about it 1,000 times, but I'm glad that it keeps getting repeated because you know, the young men and women who are joining the profession of arms need to be reminded of it. Is the story of the old. Mark, I believe it was the Mark 13, Mark 14 torpedo at the beginning of World War II, the U.S., where we just never operationally tested it, and we just wasted the first year of the war with a weapon that was never tested in a real operational sense prior to the war because it was, quote, too expensive and too embarrassing because more changes need to be made, whereas the Japanese did just the opposite. They did a lot of merciless operational testing on the long lance, and those on the receiving end of it, us, you hit right on the nail on the head. You know, the Japanese knew they had a good weapon, but it was better than even they thought. We appreciated its lethality much more than they did because we were on the receiving end of it. But it really was a great weapon. And, you know, the torpedo, though, that's kind of what we talked about in the pre-show, the ultimate game of any weapon, naval weapon, is to immobilize your enemy, to make your enemy combat ineffective. Whether you do that a piece of steel on the end of gun cotton, whether that's done on the back of a rocket motor, whether that's something pumped out by a rail gun or a warhead that's pushed along on the back of some pretty shiny little propellers on the back of a torpedo, or if you could do a soft kill with an EMP, it's all the same. How do you make your enemy combat ineffective so they don't interfere with you going forward to create the effects and to accomplish your mission? And when you get something new, whether it's a torpedo or whether it's an unmanned air system, the battle is really for those to possess this weapon to make sure that they appreciate and honestly understand its utility and also its weaknesses. And those that may be on the receiving end also get a vote on how to counter it. We thought that the heavy bomber was great and a wonderful thing until we did the big raids with no fighter cover. Then we had to wait until the P-51 came along. We could get some decent fire cover because, you know, there was that great theory of, you know, the super fortress. Look at all the guns around it. No way a fighter aircraft could take out our glorious heavy bombers. And we learned a hard lesson that way. So that's always the big battle, is having a sober appreciation of your capability and also having a sober appreciation of your enemy's capability so you can counter it. I think iteration one of our unmanned attack aircraft, I think, it's pretty easy to do iteration one and iteration two because you can't really classify math in physics, I don't think.
Yeah, I think it's pretty funny. I was looking at the Naval Institute News section, they're now developing a counter torpedo. So after all these years, I mean, close on 100 years of worrying about torpedoes, I guess we finally got a system that theoretically, based on some detection of these new torpedoes, ought to be able to intercept them and slow them down. Of course, at the same time, I wonder, you know, when I put the notice of today's show up on the Naval Institute blog, I put up a system about the Russian Rampart system, which is anti-ship missiles based on shore platforms. You know, and what's a bigger threat today, the torpedo or these anti-ship cruise missiles launched from the beach?
I tell you what, when you combine two things, when off of Lebanon, Hezbollah took the height of 1970s, 1980s anti-ship cruise missile technology and put a hole in the side of the Israeli corvette, you combine the ability to have small mobile missiles that can hide in a guy's jiffy lube with the supersonic anti-ship cruise missiles. Just we're not talking 9 miles a minute here. We're talking something infinitely faster, your reaction time. It's depending upon whose hands it is, it really does make one need to back up and question some assumptions. Can you really defend yourself against that kind of weapon? If not, what do you need to counter it? Because there's no reason to go, oh, it's so dangerous. Yes, it may be dangerous what you have right now, but how do you cost-effectively counter it? Do you move from a system where you do what previous generations did that assumes that you're going to lose ships? If you need to do something, you know, you're going to lose 20 to 30% of your ships doing it. So instead of having a lot of these large ships, which have a lot of capability in them, where if you lose one, you're all of a sudden combat ineffective, do you need to spread your forces out a little more so you can take more hits? That's the big question. I'm much more worried about the anti-ship cruise missile in a box that can be driven around with any standard issue truck that I am per se about a torpedo, because a torpedo needs a submarine. A submarine needs a trained crew, it needs a shipyard, and it needs to move from point A to point B. That really narrows down the odds of who's going to be able to deliver a torpedo to you. Who's going to be able to be trained to drive a truck, and how much money does it take to hire a third country national who is trained in weaponeering a pretty autonomous anti-ship missile to be able to elevate, aim, launch, and retreat. There's a pretty big delta in the cost in order to do that. So I'm much more concerned about the modern supersonic anti-ship cruise missiles than I really am about torpedoes, simply from the fact that it increases your threat area significantly.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just looking at this anti-torpedo torpedo and thinking that in the science fiction books, you know, they always have these aerial mines. I'm talking about old science fiction where you throw up a bunch of stuff in the air that can explode and take out a threat of an aircraft attacking you or a missile attacking you in the air. And I'm always wondering why we go to this length of relatively sophisticated systems that require precision guidance to hone in on a threat, when a lot of times we could do the same thing by putting a kind of a passive minefield behind us, say, to catch anything that was coming up our stern into our screws.
You remember those back in the Cold War? Do you remember what were those the diameter of those big ass wake homing torpedoes the Soviets had? Those things were just a beast.
Those things were huge, yeah.
I don't want to say what's at the top of my head, because if I'm wrong, then all the military trolls will come out and call me an idiot because I didn't get my millimeters right. Hey, but before we go off, I want to go dip my toe into one of your pools. Because I read something and it tied together one of your pet subjects with an article I read earlier this week. Earlier this week, I read an article that was talking about how the center of gravity of piracy is moving from the Horn of Africa over to the other side of the continent. And then in the 22 June edition of The Economist, over on page 64, they have an article about one of my boring little topics. About demographics, about facing the future. And when you look at, in 2050, there was in the top 10 most populous nations, India and China were on the top back in 1950, of course, as they are now, and they are going to be in 2050, though they're going to switch places, and by 2050, India will be larger than China by a few hundred thousand. But there were four European nations in 1950 in the top 10, no African nations. You go to 2050, there are no European nations in the top 10, and you have two African nations. Number three is going to be Nigeria, which will have a population even greater than the United States by 1950. And also Ethiopia comes in at nine, way out of the background, which, put it on my economist hat, neither one of these nations are known for their high standard of living. Neither one of them are really known for having a dynamic economy. And unless you have your economy grow at a greater rate than your population, your standard of living simply does not grow. So the economic part we discussed before about piracy, if it's economic driven, I don't think this piracy thing's going anywhere, especially in Africa when you have Nigeria and the countries around it growing at such a rate that unless the rest of the developed world is willing to take a few million Nigerians, how do they get a standard living to match their population without a Soylent Green nightmare-like situation? And how do you think that impacts
piracy? The short answer is they throw out their corrupt government and institute measures to use the oil wealth they have to do something other than enrich a very narrow subset of their population. The Gulf of Guinea piracy, I think that story is just beginning to explode. It's been around. There's a lot of it that is not being reported by the shipping companies because they don't want their rates to go up. So, and for the most part, you know, unlike Somalia, they're able to take a whole ship and put it on the beach and wait for a ransom to come in. But they have been taking ships, driving around the ocean waiting for ransoms to come in, which is a nasty new twist to that. So I think we'll hear a lot more about the Gulf of Guinea pirates here in the next few months.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to go anywhere, and which is good because we like writing about piracy, and we'll have more guests on here. I think it's going to be uglier, more unusual. You know, you mentioned about, especially a nation such as Nigeria, to be able to get a government that is more responsible to its people. And we talked earlier in the show about Syria, and you know, depending on who you're talking to, it's what 70,000 to 100,000 have been killed. Another thing to keep in mind as we decide as a nation whether we want to get involved in Syria is what precedents you state and what you start. In Nigeria, you have tribal conflict back in the 1950s, huge bloodbath right after independence in Nigeria. You have the Islamic North, the Christian and animist South, like you have in a lot of Africa. You got the economics coming in. The only way governments usually are more accountable to people is after a revolution. And if you think Syria can get bloody real fast, Nigeria, which soon is going to have a population on par with the United States, I could see that conflict going into the millions in the flip of a switch with all that oil wealth. Yeah, history hasn't gone anywhere, has it, Eagle One? Eagle One.
You know, I think we've run ourselves out of time, Sal.
yeah, give me a captive audience. Well, I guess that will bring us to an end for our summer solstice chat fest. And just a heads up to everybody, we're going to have on here soon, once he gets back. This is why writing is important. A return guest, Toshi Yoshihara, over at the Naval War College. He taught for a while as a guest lecturer over in Goa for India. So we're going to get Toshi on here pretty soon. And we'll also have a chance to talk about China, because we did a show about a year and a half ago with him on his book. I think he did it in conjunction with Jim Holmes, didn't he? Red Star Over the Pacific, about the rise of the Chinese Navy. Well, the Chinese have translated that into Mandarin and have invited him over to help kick off the book. So we could have another China Fest with Toshi at some point down the road.
That'll be fun. I look forward to that.
That will be fun. And, hey, I know all the people who are live aren't hearing a word we say, so this is for people that are with us on Archive. Thank you very much for joining us. And come back again next week. We'll get you on another episode of Midrats. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary.